and welcome back to Theory 4 Turntables, the TFT podcast. I'm Ryan. That's Matt. Hey, Matt, are we out of the woods yet? Are we out of the woods yet? Are we out of the woods yet? Are we out of the woods? Are we out of the woods yet? Are we out of the woods yet? Are we out of the woods yet? Are we out of the woods?
You stole mine.
Did I? Well, good. Just like Taylor Swift stole the sounds of Lorde and Lana Del Rey and Charlie XCX and the rest of the pop music that's happened for the last year. So it's fitting. Guys, we're doing 1989.
Boom! It's 1989. Like, we're going to take a Polaroid of ourselves from nose down to navel and post that as the album art for this podcast. No, we're not going to do that.
And then we're also going to publish brief voice memos describing the production process of this podcast itself. And to be like, well, so here, like, here's the what we'll do is we'll publish our like back channel Skype chats and other emails to one another to show you our authority. Intent and the ways in which we are auteurs, podcast auteurs.
Oh, that is so. Oh, God, those voice memos.
Yeah.
But we should explain that the standard edition of 1989 has 13 tracks on it, up through the track called "Clean," and that the edition that we listened to had additional tracks on it.
Yes. Yeah, so if you, I'd highly recommend going to Canada and getting the Canada or Target, an international Target, and getting the Target International Deluxe Edition. Because even though we talk usually about canonical versions of albums of the kind of official releases, this is a case where we listened to the Target International Deluxe version that has the three additional bonus tracks, Wonderland, You Are in Love, and New Romantics, and then three voice memos describing the production process and writing process of three of the songs, I Know Places, I Wish You Would, and Blank Space. So go to an international Target or the Waffles if you want that version. I do recommend it, going to an international Target, international House of Target, and purchasing that. So regardless, certainly get, if you have not already, get your ears between something that can convey the sounds of Taylor Swift's 1989 in whatever version you can find, and meet us back here in 48 to 68 minutes, depending on which edition you can get a hold of. And we'll be back after this word from our promotional sponsors.
Hey. Are you sick and tired of the place that you've been living?
I am.
Yeah.
Oh, how am I?
I believe you. Have you ever dreamed that there's a city out there that's just like waiting for you?
Oh, yeah. See, because like so many other cities, I feel like just go on about their way and don't concern themselves with me. What city is this? Is it Nashville?
No, it's not Nashville.
Huh. Is it Boston?
No, it's not Boston. You'll never believe what city it is.
I give up.
It's New York.
New York?
New York City.
You mean that concrete streets where dreams are made of?
No. You're thinking of a different New York. This is the New York where the village is aglow, a kaleidoscope, and that you wouldn't change anything, including the stop and frisk policing, including the Banana Republic level income inequality, including the pervasive smell of poop on the streets. No matter where you go, you would not change a single thing.
Oh, so it's the New York, the notional new New York, where Bloomberg never leaves, and we all get what we deserve.
You know you love me, XOXO, New York.
And we're back.
Yeah,
I was going to. My ad was going to be: is your beat sick?
I know we have 30 minutes of shucking and jiving to do about all kinds of bullshit before we jump into
I just figured that this one's going to go for 10 hours.
The New York, what New York is it that she's talking about, and who is the you in It's Been Waiting for You, right? Mm. Like, I think that's
her. The you is her, right?
Right. Yeah, it is. Absolutely. This is a song that's to her and to her, you know, ability to buy a $60 million penthouse apartment, or two of them, and knock down the walls between them to make a giant, like, mega compound, you know, at the top of a building in Tribeca or something. Like, I forget where it is. You can look on Gawker if you want to figure out the exact real estate that's going on. But this is a Gossip Girl New York, right? Like, this is a New York. This is a song that's for people who are in song that's for people who are in Gossip Girl. You know,
So I have a question for you, and this is, and I didn't have this question until you mentioned this, but then this is a question that goes a little bit to our older fan base, those who have been with us since day one, or at least gone back all the way to episode day one. But Matt, if Taylor Swift were on Gossip Girl, or were a Gossip Girl character, which one would she be?
Oh, that's a really good question.
I don't even know if I know how to answer it, because it just came to me.
Yeah,
I'm
gonna go out on a limb here. I'm gonna say she's Chivy.
Huh? Yep.
Right.
And for those of you who are newer listeners, Chivy is the is our internal nickname for for Charlie / Ivy, who starts as the cousin of the elite Vanderwoodson family, and then it is learned. So is Charlie what, Rhodes, I believe?
She goes by Lola, doesn't she? The actual real one goes by Lola.
Well, right. And so, in the wonderful soap opera-ness of Gossip Girl, we learn that this Charlie is not the real Charlie, but is in fact a actress named Ivy who's been hired by Charlie's mother to impersonate Charlie and get her inheritance, I believe. So in what ways is Taylor Swift a graduate of the Chivy League?
Well, I think that she's – I mean, I think the idea is she's sort of an interloper, right? Like, she's sort of going into it, but can I think almost kind of outplay the natives at that game. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something we talked about Gossip Girl when this was a Gossip Girl podcast, and I suppose today, for one more day, it will be a Gossip Girl podcast again. We talked about the way that the social body in Gossip Girl could expel mm-hmm. outsiders, except for certain extraordinary outsiders whose you know, unique pathogenic qualities, right, in the social body of the outsiders could sort of Ebola like liquefy the oh god, that's macabre, but who could kind of graft on
these songs spread just as fast.
As if you play them in a bowling alley in Brooklyn, then you know a whole bunch of people are going to be infected by them. The social body could be sort of altered, right? Or the parasite could kind of graft onto the host, in a particular way. Not through impersonation, and not through asking to belong, but through a kind of assertion of self, right, in the face of the forces that would expel the outside force. So the idea that, like, New York has been waiting for you, New York has been waiting for me, right? There's no sense in this song that you have to earn anything, right, or that you have to, like, overcome anything, right? The idea of, like, Empire State of Mind is that, like, is that like you grind it out. You grind it out on the streets and you achieve something, you know? That like it's gritty and it's hard, but you stick with it. This is just kind of like, this is sort of waltzing in, you know, and it's just like, oh, it's waiting for you. Welcome to New York. Welcome. Like, unless you're a tourist coming to spend your money, I don't think anyone really has felt welcomed to New York in the history of.
Yeah, welcome to New York. Go fuck yourself.
Exactly. Right? Have you ever tried to get off a train in Manhattan? Or, right, like, get off Amtrak or Metro North? Like, you will be jostled and run over.
New York waits for no one.
Exactly. Least of all for puny old you, you know? And that, like, I actually quite like that. I quite like that, like, that's that, like, sense of, because I try to live my life with a keep moving or get out of the way attitude, right? Like, get out of the fucking way. I almost always stop passive aggressively behind people who, rather than like edging around them, who are stopped in doorways or walkways or things like this in the office or in, you know, in public spaces or things like that. It's because it's like, what the fuck are you doing? What are you waiting for, right? Like, oh, what a great place to stop for a conversation in the middle of a doorway that's part of an active path of egress from this restaurant. You, sir, are a genius. Right. And like, New York just won't tolerate that. You just, you know, you will get run down if you do that. Right. And I think, ironically, it's the Swiftian attitude, you know, it's the Swiftian assumption that everything is just going to go your way that actually allows you to graft yourself onto that social body, because you don't ask for its permission. You know what I mean?
Right. No, and I think that that's right. That it is just saying, like, well, of course you've been waiting for me. And that there's not a lot of a concern about. There's not an asking for permission, but there's rather an assertion of authority and of entitlement to that authority, and I think that there's a lot of elements of this elsewhere on the album or in the way that it's presented, but I think that you know, the fact, I mean it is interesting, right, that. What does it mean to be starting this album with "Welcome to New York"? What tone does that set? And how does this kind of what you're identifying about what this is conveying about these kind of Swiftian assumptions? How does this reverberate throughout a lot of the rest of 1989 in your listen? Question mark.
Sorry, I was talking for like 15 seconds on mute. I think that the idea, and it was brilliant, but I'll never get it back. The idea here, I think, would be like the right critical tool is rewrite it in a different way, right? And so what is the not New York, right? What is New York standing in for, or what is the default that New York is supplanting? And I think it's Nashville, right? I think it's like that this is an announcement about genre and about brand positioning and about the kind of future direction of Taylor Swift's music. Rather than being kind of ghettoized in the country ghetto, you know, this is we're now like, welcome to New York. The Brill Building is this away, you know.
Yeah,
welcome to New York. The kind of the pop music establishment is this away.
Welcome to New York. Please enter the Chrysler Building and let Cremaster 3 begin.
I don't know. It is like, is this the New York of Cremaster 3 and of you know, of the Guggenheim and of Per Se and of, you know, the Upper East Side? Or is this the New York of you know, Chevy's on 42nd Street and the Guy Fieri restaurant and like New Year's Eve in Times Square and, you know, walking up and down Fifth Avenue or something like that, right? Like seeing the Banana Republic and the Tiffany's, or well, I guess it is the Tiffany's, but you know what I mean. What is the New York that's being referenced here? You know,
I think it's neither of those.
Yeah.
I think it is weirdly, and you know, you mentioned the Polaroids. When I was looking again at the Polaroid of the album cover, a Polaroid, and we'll put this link in the show notes. What it actually reminded me of is a famous set of Polaroids by Andy Warhol, of celebrities, that he did in the 80s, in the early to mid 80s, late 70s. So kind of the period right where we left off. And I think that there's something important about that, and there's a lot of hay is being made about how this is, and I noticed this quote, I think somewhere in the Wikipedia article, but I've seen this a few other places, where you know, there's a quote from Taylor of describing this as her first documented official pop album.
Uh-huh.
And man, there are like so many like words to parse in that.
Uh-huh.
And I want to talk about kind of documentation first and documentation in a minute. But I think that in terms of pop album, I think that weirdly seeing the Warhol echo in the Polaroid made me think about it pop as modifying not music, but as modifying art, as pop art, and thinking specifically about actually discussions that we had weirdly in the discussion on the Velvet Underground. And so I'm not saying that this is the New York of the Velvet Underground and of Andy Warhol, but I think this is the New York of the Andy Warhol diffusion line at Uniqlo. And that is the New York that this is. And this is the New York, right, that you know, that also, and I think it is like the New York of Uniqlo, and where this kind of rapid fire fusion of commerce and art and indie and mainstream, and of normcore and basic, of just all these Olympic ring Ouroboros just like linked to one another and pooping in each other's mouths over and over, if that makes sense, right? That I think, and I think that Andy Warhol is central to that, in part because of his you know, of his role as kind of both an artist, but of kind of a manager of process and a delegator. Because I think that a lot of what's interesting about this album are kind of, and I think that, and we can maybe, you know, talk about the voice memos here, it are the ways in which, you know, she's not making a claim for, you know, she's all, another New York that it is not the New York of Dylan. And it's not, you know, or the, some of the other kind of indie singer songwriters, or even some of the, you know, punk, you know, songwriters and punk bands that we've talked about throughout the last historical sweep. So she's not really claiming authenticity, really, on the voice memos where she talks about writing the songs, because in every one of the voice memos she talks about the other songwriter that she was sending the memo to, right, to the one to Jack Antonoff, you know, of Fun period and Bleachers fame, who co-wrote two of the songs on the album, or to Max, or like a recording of her working with Max Martin.
Well, so okay, I mean, like, we're there, let's do it now, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah. I think what I just want to say is that what I think these are doing is showing her as a manager and as this kind of like a person who is like, in fact, at such a high level, a manager of the making, a manager of pop art products, right? And that she is so assured in her ability to write songs and create and be you know, a visionary, is that she can manage these other songwriters. And but that she has the kind of overall vision, and then the rest of it is mechanical. And I feel like that's what is.
Yeah,
is,
but so I mean, yeah, that's interesting. But like the thing that I want to say that I want to point out in what you've said is like she is a sort of non-generative visionary, right? The idea is that you bring me options and I'll tell you which of the options are good, rather than like I'm going to set a direction. I guess you set a direction in you know, insofar as you choose certain collaborators and not others, right? Like Max Martin would be a very different collaborator than like, I don't know, Andy Warhol would be, or, right? Which, but
yeah, at most it's meta generativity, right?
That sure.
There's generativity at the, you know, her Tumblr is a Rolodex of like powerful pop songwriters and producers.
Right. I want to associate my brand with that Max Martin brand, right? Like, yeah. I want to associate my brand with that Imogen Heap brand.
Yeah, yeah. It's basically Brill building Tumblr, right? Yeah. And that you know, rather than it just living on Tumblr, it becomes a, you know, what will certainly be a number one pop album that has, you know, several top 10 singles, right? But there is a kind of bricolage there, but at the level of collaborators and like the moving of not only kind of collaborators, but, you know, capital and resources and things like that. I think the idea of it being non-generative is interesting, because it is. Well, I mean, so cash that out a little bit. Is there a specific one of the recordings that made you think about that? Because I think they paint a diverse kind of picture.
Sorry, I keep interrupting you, but I'm so excited. I mean, it's...
I am too. Don't worry.
Who knew?
This is a safe space.
Who knew this would be the... this would be the one that did it for us, right? Okay, so there are three... right? Like... I know the ones for I Know Places, where she is playing on a piano, like, and I think like accompanying herself on a keyboard or something like this, and singing, sending a lyric idea, right? So that's one mode of, right? That's one mode of songwriting. And these things showcase three modes of what she calls songwriting, right? Like,
And that's the one that she's sending to Ryan Tedder, who is a pretty prolific pop songwriter and I believe frontman/songwriter for the pop rock band One Republic.
Okay, cool. So that's going to Ryan Tedder, right? And it's like, and so what that is the sketch on the cocktail napkin model, right? Like, you send this off to right, and then there's the other one, which is the you know, it's so funny, like tracks, like there, you know, in what sense are you a songwriter, right? If all you do is kind of chant over tracks that someone else has done, but like there is essentially a finished instrumental version.
So what you're saying is that Taylor Swift is the greatest rapper alive.
Yeah, definitely. That's what I'm saying. You know, the idea that like there's a full fledged karaoke track, like the song began as its own karaoke track, you know, Taylor Swift like records a vocal, sends it back, and that, right, like in some sense the that, which one was that? That was Jack Antonoff, right?
Yeah, the Jack Antonoff one.
Yeah, and so it's like so that, like, it's the way she made it sound on the voice memo, right, is she made it sound as though she had to, this was like, hey, Jack Antonoff, I like your song, please let me use it, right? So that she's like not even the owner, really, of whether she gets to record the song. And then the third one is messing around in the studio with and kind of fucking around with Max Martin and Shellback. In the studio, So this is like, this is actually more, as you would imagine, like bands writing songs, kind of sitting together, riffing, you know, making music, you know, having happy accidents and things like that. But like so much of that labor is outsourced, right? Like this is not how we imagine Tori Amos sitting down and writing songs, right? Like this is not how we imagine John Darnielle sitting down and writing songs or any of the other slightly artsier singer-songwriters. And though she has a songwriting credit on everything she does and sort of came to prominence as being this sort of songwriting prodigy who, when she was a teenager, was actually developing her own material. What we mean by authorship, in this case is perhaps a little problematic and could do with some unpacking. I'm also really taken with the idea of a documented album, pop album. And I'm not quite sure what that really means. Right. Like,
well, and I think that this is part of it, right. That these recordings are interesting. They're one sense of documenting the popness, and in this way of like, it's this interesting thing where, you know, it's addressing any kind of a charge about, oh, you don't actually write all your own songs. And she sort of says, well, in fact, that's the case. But let me show you through this documentation that, I mean, I argue that the kind of rhetorical move is because if it was exposing a weakness, it would not be there. Right. And so I think that I see, especially on the Jack Antonoff track, the Bleachers track, that rather than yes, there's a little bit of her saying, please let me use your song, and then her singing over the karaoke track. But I think that there's also, I mean, in the description, the way she recounts the story and frames the narrative is that she sort of says, he played this track and I heard the whole song. And it reminds me of this a line from Jay-Z, I think from the song The Takeover, that is about kind of a beef that Jay-Z had with Nas, and that Jay-Z in the song Dead Presidents samples Nas saying, I'm out for presidents to represent me, from Nas's song The World Is Yours. And there's like basically in when there was a major beef at the time of the kind of height of the beef between Jay-Z and Nas, Nas was complaining about this and saying basically Jay-Z ripped me off. And what Jay-Z says in The Takeover is, you made it a hot line, I made it a hot song. And I think that this has been a Jay-Z move in a lot of ways throughout his career, of that actually this kind of high profile bricolage, whether that is at the level of lines within individual songs and kind of borrowing liberally from multiple influences, or at the level of, especially on albums like The Blueprint and The Black Album, of kind of curating a set of collaborators and producers that are kind of the best in the game at the time, and then later moving into Jay-Z as a mogul, as a record label person, and as a kind of multimedia and kind of multi entertainment channel, you know, boss who can kind of puts the right people in the room together. And I kind of feel like from that read of kind of the micro linguistics of specifically the framing of that the middle voice recording, but all three of them together, I feel like is her saying, you know, you can have your, you know, like you can have your John Darnielle pennies or your or you're in Tori Amos quarters, I'm going for my Jay-Z and Beyonce stacks on stacks on stacks. Uh-huh. Right. And so this Taylor Swift is in the empire business.
Right.
And that is also the way in which the New York that she is entering is the empire state, right? She is, she's in an empire state of mind. Specifically,
she's in an imperial state of mind.
Right. Exactly. Right? Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so that, and so as a result, that when you are building your empire, you know, this goes back to the documentation, because it's amazing how a lot of the media has bought into the narrativization of this is Taylor Swift's first pop album. I'm like, sorry, has every pop music writer not listened to Red? That classic country ditty, we are never, ever, ever getting back together. Many of the songs there are that and 22 especially, are absolutely pop songs, heavily on it depends on how you're arraying the pop country conceptual space, but they're in a pop quadrant, or they're in a pop side of that in some way. But that, you know, again, there's a element to document the the beginning of a regime and the history of the empire, and so this documentation is a is part of this process of myth making and telling the legitimating myth.
There you go.
Of the empire of Taylor.
Yeah, that's exactly it, right? Like, you began sort of by focusing as documentation in the sense of like documentary, that we're sort of documenting the process in these three voice memos. But I wanted to connect it also to documentation in the sense that an immigrant can be undocumented, right?
Right.
In the sense that like an immigrant to New York, right? An interloper, right? Can be undocumented. And, you know, setting, you know, this, self-creating documentation that makes you a sort of documented member of a society, right? That is to say, you sort of make your own title. You know, you don't need someone to give it. You don't need someone to give it to you. And I have to say, right, that like, despite some of my longstanding beefs with Taylor Swift songwriting, which I think is kind of melodically impoverished, and even like, you know, and that's part of that is its poppiness, you know, but part of that is a quirk of hers, because there are plenty of pop songs that have decent melodies, that have sort of melodic movements, and even in these things you can see her kind of like chanting on a single note, and sort of chanting like the rhythmic. It's almost more rhythmic. I mean, maybe Taylor Swift is the greatest rapper
maybe
alive.
Taylor Swift is the I'll say it, this is not Taylor Swift's first pop album. This is Taylor Swift's first rap album. she's been in rap country for a while. I'd say Red was rap rock, and this is her rap album. You heard it here first.
I love that. Red was this sort of Kid Rock, like Limp Bizkit kind of, you know. So yes.
Sum 41, I'd say. Sum 41.
creating her own documentation. And like, there is a claim to originality in doing this, right? And, you know, I connected to the idea in the first verse of Welcome to New York. Everyone coming to New York was searching for a sound we hadn't heard before. And yet the sound of this record is really a throwback throughout to like, I kept thinking of like, even like Depeche Mode or, you know, I don't know, mm-hmm. Tears for Fears or like 80s synth pop, right? Actually, kind of the stuff. It's great, crazy coincidence that this comes up where it does. Just after we kind of did our historical quarter where we talked about post-punk and new wave music, just about to get into like the synth pop, you know, of the 1980s, and here comes this thing which has this sort of throwback record. Like I don't know, I don't hear Lorde in this as much, and I think that, like, well, if she's, I mean, I wouldn't call it stealing, if she's influenced by Lorde, so much the better. More people should be influenced by Lorde, but I hear the 1980s in this in such a strong way. Right, even more than like if Sweden is going where Tuvalu is going, this is really like sort of American, or this is really back to Germany, you know, for its roots, you know. This is a post Krautrocket, you know, post the impact of the Krautrocket when it came into London and the States, and sort of spawned this genre of synth pop that a lot of, like, especially English bands took and ran with, right?
Well, yeah. And I think, though, and it's interesting, I saw another quote from Taylor Swift that argues, I mean, I think this is interesting, right? So there is elements of kind of early 80s synth pop, early and mid 80s synth pop. But then her justification for the connection to 1989, other than it being her birth year, is something that's a bit further away from what we discussed, is kind of the recapture or repurposing of the Krautrocket, let's say if the Krautrocket hit the Brill Building, then the survivors recobbled and made a better rocket. And then what I'm talking about is kind of just the pop of the late 80s. And so she specifically said, to read this quote, "I have a few artists in the late 80s who I think made the most incredible, bold, risky decision as far as pop music goes. They were really ahead of their time, like Annie Lennox and what Madonna was doing in the late 80s. Like a Prayer is legitimately one of the greatest pop songs of all time." And I think that that is an interesting place to situate this, alongside some of the other synth pop and new wave music, in addition to also, like, another piece that I think is of kind of a sub-genre that's worth mentioning, that is more explicitly British, is new romanticism, which is bands like Duran Duran, I believe kind of Boy George and Culture Club were kind of around here a little bit. I believe Adam and the Ants, and that it was a kind of you know, fusion of some of the sounds of new wave and synth pop with some of these types of art rock stylings and glam stylings of Bowie et al. And also, let's note that there is in the bonus tracks and in the extended tracks a track called New Romantics, and so that connection to that kind of early mid 80s movement and kind of specific piece of synth pop, I think, is also important. And so I think that there's a few pieces here. But I mean, what do you think about the claim to identify not just with the kind of synth pop and kind of, you know, descendants of punk, but the kind of the more pop lineage of the pop, comma, synth?
sort of claiming Madonna as a,
yes, yeah.
I mean, who? Well, so right. So,
well, I think that's interesting, because, like, who isn't influenced by Madonna?
Yeah. You can't not be, right? Like, yeah, that's like saying, you know, you're really influenced by the Beatles, right? It's that goes hand in hand with, like, eating food and drawing breath in this world.
But I think that that is also, I think, doing, claiming an obvious influence as an influence, I think is an interesting rhetorical move.
Well, right, because we've been talking so much about legitimacy and legitimacy is concerned with dissent, right? Is concerned with relationships of like testamentary relationships,
exactly,
right? And like who's the legitimate heir to Madonna, right? And so that's a shot across the bow of Lady Gaga, I think, right? Like that is to say, this much less challenging, I mean, right, much less kind of socially conscious and in certain ways like much less challenging music of Taylor Swift, like versus the music of Lady Gaga, right? She claims, in fact, the sort of legitimate heir to a song, to a song like a Prayer, which by the way, right? Like that song was banned. Like that was, I remember like even young as I was at the time, I remember how, controversial that was, right? Like when the video for Like a Prayer came out, like,
hey man, like Welcome to New York still might get banned, but for very different reasons.
So you know, so like it's very, I mean, it's very interesting, like the move from sort of Madonna, from Like a Prayer to this Taylor Swift record is actually kind of like the move from like 1970s New York to 2014 New York, right? To sort of New York as, you know, as fertile but dangerous cultural, culture generating playground, to sort of New York as prepackaged, you know, right, sort of prepackaged like culture light, culture commodity experience, you know? You know, right? Like,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's back to the Andy Warhol diffusion line at Uniqlo,
yeah,
right? Or
exactly.
It's also, we talked about that a little bit this, I think, on the Ramones episode, or maybe one of the subsequent episodes. It's the distinction between and transition from CBGB to Danielle Boulud's DBGB,
yeah,
right? And that it's, these things are there. And that there's still a reference to them and a call to legitimacy, but in a kind of productized and kind of sanitized manner. And so I think that that's interesting. I always want to return to something that you were saying about legitimacy and kind of claims of descent, of being a legitimate heir. And it actually reminds me of something that I was thinking of, as I was listening to this album and thinking a lot about these, themes and about our conversation from, I guess, 2 weeks ago in our recap episode about the current state of pop and it feeling to be more fragmented, or rather than having one queen bee. We were feeling it when we were discussing and comparing Lorde and Meghan Trainor. There were at least kind of multiple claims being made. And I actually, what it makes me think of, is kind of the second book, in the George R.R. Martin books, in the Song of Ice and Fire, and in the second season of the Game of Thrones TV show, of the, you know, a clash of kings, right? So we have a clash of pop queens going on, and that there are many claims to legitimacy being made, right? And you have and I mean, I kind of want to draw the map of pop Westeros and see, right? And so it's interesting that we started with Gossip Girl and are ending up at Game of Thrones, and I think that you know, we actually have not really ever done any comparative discussions of the two explicitly on Overthinking It, or on this podcast when it was a Gossip Girl podcast, and so I think that this kind of these claims to legitimacy like exist in part in this context of a more ruptured kind of pop kingdom, and there being a lot of let's say bastardization, and so that it creates space that in fact it's a really kind of crowded pop space of different of different claims being made and being fought out, both on the battlefield of the billboard battlefield, as well as in the kind of, you know, various smoke filled rooms of the internet, and so I think that it's, I don't know, I mean, do you have any reactions to kind of viewing the current landscape as a pop Westeros?
Yeah,
in which winter is coming.
Well, I mean, I think winter has already come, right? I mean, I think this is the kind of the post Napster world. You know, you can't, like, all the money has gone out of the record business except for these kind of mega superstars, and I think that's what kind of gives stakes to this kind of death match for who is in fact the queen bee, right? You can't make money in the record business unless you're selling out stadiums, right? Or you can't make the sorts of obscene, you know, Scrooge McDuck pile of gold coin style profits that used to be more common in the record business, right? Like, a lot of money has gotten just sucked out of the business with the decline in album sales. And so, like, you need these incredibly huge, like, Beyonce level personalities.
Yep.
And I think that's what we have in Taylor Swift. I think that's what we have in Beyonce. Lorde, I think actually, like, I have almost a little too much respect for Lorde's artistry, right? To lump her in with those people. And I think it remains to be seen, actually, right, whether Lorde goes the way of Tori Amos or the way of Taylor Swift, you know? Nothing Tori Amos ever did was as popular as Lorde's first album, I think. But there were times, like, Cornflake Girl was a popular single on what was then called, I guess, alternative radio in the early 90s, right? Like,
right.
So there was a sense in which, like, well, maybe this is someone who's becoming a pop singer songwriter, and then she released Boys for Pele and went, like, really weird.
Oh, man, I would love for, like, Lorde's next album to be her Boys for Pele.
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess, yeah, what you're saying is, like, two Lordes diverge in a yellow wood. And will she take the Lorde less traveled? The Lorde not taken.
but then you have these sort of I don't even know what to call them, these sort of pop conglomerates, right? These sort of female fronted pop conglomerates, where you need to be almost as much of a mogul as you do as you need to
exactly.
be an artist, a songwriter, a musician. And I actually, I mean, look, I gotta say, right, like, politically, you know, this is always a bit of a straw man, right? Like, the role model for young girls, right? Like, but there's a lot that I find really admirable about Taylor Swift and about the sense in which she seems to relate to music like a boss, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of like a lot like Beyonce. And I would love to see Taylor Swift up there with a giant feminist, you know, projected on the screen, the word feminist projected on the screen behind her, right? Like, also just to, like, you know, just to establish that this is a model that's, you know, this is a model that's sort of here to stay, right? And so as admirable as I find it, as someone who is interested in things that I find interesting or pathbreaking, rather than things that are, you know, merely appealing or merely successful, whether it's for me or not, I guess there is something that I find admirable and sort of interesting about it. But it's less at the level of the individual song and more at the level of the larger construction that I put on the meaning of the production of this artifact at all.
Well, I think, I mean, I think it's so to maybe try a reframe, it's even less about even like thinking about the individual song, because I think that they, the definite singles here, you know, Shake It Off, and then the likely singles, which I think, include, I believe, Blank Space, the second track is going to be a single, is going to be the next single. I do feel like Out of the Woods, or one of the, or the other Jack Antonoff track have, single potential down the road, of that these singles, like, you know, they either appeal to you now or they will appeal to you, as they kind of become, ubiquitous. But the album as a whole, it coheres less, right? That you know, we don't, last week with Tuve Lu, talked about album oriented pop, and this is not that.
No, absolutely not. Yeah.
Even though there is kind of our attempts at cohesive, album orientedness, in the in some of the visual branding, and in like a, at least, you know, her living in the new synths. Half of my two playlists, as Chris Morgan, identified correctly in the comments for last week, and the whole album wasn't there yet, but Shake It Off, actually most of the pop built, the Billboard top 10 at the time I was making the list, I slotted into new synths. I think in part because they all lived in that space, this is not living in a album oriented pop world. And so I think that in part makes it harder to that there's like individual singles, I think, that we will like and are going to be part of, you know, that, you know, we will, I will sing at least one of these, one, if not all of these songs at karaoke, within the next, 6 to 12 months, and, you know, in the past
just,
6 to 12,
you're just going to work your way through all the songs.
Sure. As released, I'm sure the ones that are going to be released as singles and then we'll make it onto, K-Town karaoke, lists are the ones that I will want to sing. I know, Mark Lee and I, duetted, Taylor Swift's, 22, at his 32nd birthday, karaoke party. And so that he also is a fan of the Taylor Swift karaoke song. I believe I've done a number of Taylor Swift songs at karaoke. One or more of these may become some kind of a meme, either due to a music video or an appropriation in something else, in an ad or in on TV, or the, you know, there's going to be a few. There's going to be a fat tail a number of these songs, and
just without, in terms of your own identity bricolage, your own Tumblr,
we're going to be retumbling this for a while,
sure.
But pieces of this, kind of small pieces of this. And then at the kind of biggest level of an entire kind of, like you were saying, political project or kind of pop art factory, or kind of management case study, you know, Harvard Business School case study.
Right.
It's also very interesting. But as an album, I don't think that's not where it is sticky, necessarily. And where it's most interesting to us in our kind of album orientation, and is why we've spent, I think, so much time up in the balcony rather than down on the dance floor.
Yeah.
But you know, to go on to the either, maybe we should end on the literal or metaphorical dance floor. Are there any, you know, even saying like how we found the kind of highest level of abstraction most entertaining? Are there any, and you know, we don't necessarily need to talk about the album level of abstraction, but are there at the song level or kind of sonic level, even sub song level, either the level of the line or the level of the beat, at a more disaggregated level, other kind of specific sonic moments or lyrical moments that you found to be interesting on this album, either in relation to what we've been discussing or kind of orthogonal to it?
Yeah, I mean, yes. And I can't remember what they are. Right?
Me neither, right?
Like, I don't really connect I don't connect the other than Welcome to New York because it's so, you know, just because it is the first song, maybe like, and also there's been some commentary and controversy about, you know, gentrification and income disparity and, you know, the new New York, the post Bloomberg New York. I sort of don't connect any of these things with their lyrics, right? Like sonically, you know, sonically it's like, oh yeah, the one that was the echoey one that had the, you know, that had the synth drums on it, right? Like right. is how I think of them, is how they sort of stuck with me as I was listening to this. I don't know. Do you have one? And maybe I can kind of surreptitiously play the first beats of a couple of these while you talk and figure out which ones I mean.
I guess we can talk a little bit about Blank Space, which is one of the ones that is, the last of the voice memos. And it is one of the ones that was, co-written with Max Martin. It was one of the ones that's mentioned, I think, in a New York Magazine article that we tweeted out, and about kind of asking whether, I think it was New York Magazine or it was some publication asking whether, you know, Taylor Swift, and whether this album was influenced by Lorde and Lana Del Rey. And I believe Blank Space was one of the songs that was referenced there, in that at least in the synth, the nature of the synth drum beat was described as being reminiscent of some of the beats on Pure Heroine, and most notably Tennis Court, and to an extent Team as well. So I think that there's, I agree that on Blank Space, part of what's interesting is the sonic element. But like, I think that Blank Space is interesting for a few reasons. To kind of jump in on the
lyrics, are you
playing? On the lyrics, I think there's a few different pieces. I'm trying to figure out which part to jump in on. In some ways, it circles back. It was one that I was thinking about a little bit when we were actually at the top of the show, to kind of circle it back on Taylor Swift as Chivy and as the interloper. Is that this is actually one that specifically references New Money, right? That describing this guy that she's meeting, New Money, suit and tie. I can read you like a magazine. Ain't it funny? Rumors lie, and I know you heard about me. So hey, let's be friends. I'm dying to see how this one ends. Grab your passport and my hand. I can make bad guys good for a weekend.
Yeah.
And there's a lot there that are both about, right, that weirdly, right, that this is actually her almost this is like a plot line where like Chivy briefly seduces Chuck Bass or something like that.
Yeah.
Or if either Chuck Bass or Dan, I guess in the real show, she seduces Rufus, right? For all you Gossip Girl fans, we still got it. But that, you know, there's an engagement with the discourse of both, New Money and jetting away for the weekend, grabbing because it's, you know, going, you know, somewhere that needs a passport for a weekend is something very much in the Gossip Girl world. And so I think that there's a setting up of that world. And then there's the, you know, that I think what's interesting in the chorus, in the pre-chorus, is that it is engagement not just with the type of – this is a meta ex-boyfriend song, right? Because
yes.
It's like
– Yeah, yeah, and engaging with the sort of – engaging with the narrative of like Taylor Swift is a man-eater or something like
that. Right, exactly. And she's like, you know, that she has a long list of ex-lovers and they'll tell you I'm insane because you know I love the players – and you love the game. And that's also like an interesting view on one of our old hobby horses of structure and agency.
Yeah.
And because once you recognize both the players and the game, you are yourself up in the balcony, right? Because you're not on the board, that you are recognizing the game and the players, right? And so that you're kind of seeing the structure and agency. So that in some ways that there's a self-awareness of this, you know, this relationship is a song, right? The relationship is a song waiting to happen.
Sure.
And vice versa. The song creates the relationship. The song and the relationship are kind of are co-creating, or they co-produce one another. If that makes sense. Right. And so there's kind of I think that that's part of what's interesting, and what's going on.
Would you accept a broken heart if it got you a top 40 single, right? That's a sort of Faustian bargain. I'd have to think about before I said I was unwilling to make, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting though. I mean, and it is an interesting thing where, like, the flip side of that is, how many times can you keep going back to that well, right? Is heartbreak a depletable common pool natural resource? Are we at peak heartbreak? Have we passed peak heartbreak? And are we basically out of our heartbreak reserves? And I think that this engages with that a little bit, and kind of the extent to which there is a, you know, alternative heartbreak sources, and getting off of heartbreak oil.
Yeah. So one that was sort of sonically interesting to me, now that I've kind of gone through and listened on the Genius streaming page to all of these, I want to talk about like Out of the Woods a little bit, just sure. sort of like mm-hmm. just sort of as being like one of the most 80s of them, yeah. just because of the kind of like the synth bass line, the way the reverb is programmed, and the way some of the synth drums are programmed, right?
Yeah.
Like,
and even, yeah, and this, and I think just as a framing thing before you jump in, is this is one of the two Jack Antonoff songs, and if you are liking this song sound and you haven't heard it yet, definitely check out the Bleachers album that was out or released earlier this year, because it all kind of sounds like this, and yeah. it's very, very kind of coherent in this sound. This is the album. I believe it's Strange Desire by Bleachers, and that's a great album that lives in that space.
So it's interesting because like I like the parsing. You can really tell once you get conversant in it, right? The kind of the parsing of the synth pop into its micro genres, right? Because mm-hmm. this is a different synth pop than like track 10, How You Get the Girl, which is yep. more of a Chvrches synth pop yep. To my ear, or to the Imogen Heap synth pop on Clean, right?
Right.
Which is a much more sort of what was her band? Frou Frou, or you know. Under as her sort of solo act, Imogen Heap synth pop. Right? There is a kind of richness and variety to it, but you have to be kind of indoctrinated right. into the particular micro genres right. that are being right. referenced.
Right, and there's also the Charlie XCX synth pop on Bad Blood, I
sure.
believe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was, and that has a little bit of Lord as well, but I think even more so, it's Charlie XCX, and which are themselves have their own kind of pieces of reference.
So an interesting thing, right? Like if you accept my sort of. The hobby horse that Taylor Swift doesn't really write melodies. The thing that becomes in the absence of melody, the thing that becomes interesting next in line, I think, is rhythm, right? And mm-hmm. it's interesting how often vocal samples, like samples of oohs and ohs and ahs mm-hmm. and things like that, are used percussively, right, throughout the record.
Yep.
And this is sort of Chvrches. This is a common synth pop thing yeah. to do, right? Like Chvrches starts The Bones of What You Believe with this with this vocal sample. And a couple of the tracks on this start also, but it's almost like taking the voice, which through the lyrics is being used percussively. Even in her ideas, even in actually the song sketches in the voice memos, it's clear that she's really thinking rhythmically. Right. And that's okay. That's okay. I think that the best hooks marry that with a sense of melody and harmony. Right. That just the, that just the best pop hooks that you can, think of. And I'm trying to they're not coming to me right now as I say them, but really marry all three in a way that's a kind of perfect symbiosis of, of all the elements, or a perfect synthesis, I should say. Symbiosis means something different. A perfect sort of synthesis of all the elements. But the idea that even as she's writing at the piano, even as it's just her, singing, into the iPhone or whatever, it's like, this is the hook, yeah, the hook, you know what I mean? Where that's how her mind kind of structures the song around that rhythmic thing. And so it's sort of an appropriate thing. I mean, the sort of synth pop gesture of the vocal sample that's used percussively is an appropriate, means of kind of elaborating on that, in the production, right? In the sort of production of the songs.
Well, I think that, and actually one of the songs I think that you're referencing there is I Know Places, the one late in the album, that was co-written with Ryan Tedder. And I think that actually really struck me in that, the vocal samples in the original struck me in a similar way. And then what's really interesting though, is that in the piano one, she also sings the vocal samples, and I think that one interpretation is that that's kind of how her songwriting brain works, is in this kind of rhythmic level. The other is my kind of Taylor Swift truther conspiracy theory that all of these voice memos were recorded, in fact, after the album was produced, and that that it's not even that the documents are forged, right? And so I mean, come on, wake up, sheeple. I think that regardless of whether you think that whether you demand the time stamped voice memos, or whether you are a kind of unquestioningly loyal to their authenticity, there's a lot to talk about and think about here on this album. Definitely give the album a listen if you actually listened the whole way through this without obeying our suggestion to go and listen to it, because you figured you'd heard enough as they trickled out over the various internet tubes. But definitely continue the conversation. Hop on the comments in the show notes on Overthinking It, overthinkit.com, or hit us up on Twitter at TFT Podcast, or on Facebook, our newly active, reactivated and reinvigorated Facebook page. So kind of continue in on the comment. And we've been kind of sharing a lot of pieces of Taylor Swift media. And I think there will only be more and more pieces of criticism and think pieces and fan art and whatever kind of comes out as this album makes it around over the next few weeks. So as we engage with the 1989, and regardless of whether we know places or whether we are out of the woods or whether all you find is a blank space in New York, what we can assure you is that it most certainly has been real.